why don't we start? And so this is the panel which I proposed, so they have put me in charge as the grand poobah. You can't teach writing and how we do it. And so what I'd like to do to start is the typical drill of having everyone introduce themselves, but I'd like to also throw a curveball at my panel and say, what, if any, writing study have you done? I mean, other than the typical thing which writers do is read a whole lot. Have you ever taken writing courses and did you feel they were helpful? So your introduction starting with you.
Oh my gosh, I'm first. Okay, hi. Okay. I'm Lee Hillman, also known as Gwendolyn Grace. And I guess one of the things I will say at the outset is that while I'm here, because I'm part of the Badass Fairies launch, come tonight, 7:30, yay. I am also primarily a fanfic writer, so I'm kind of presenting that perspective. But in terms of writing classes or whatever, I kind of have to go back to the old standby and give a lot of credit to my high school writing teacher, yeah. Mr. Lasser, also known as the Lacerator. I guess I took a couple of creative writing classes in college, but mainly it was like just studying lit and being told by a lot of teachers along the way, you should write. No, thank you.
My name is Mer Lafferty, and I took a couple of classes in college by teachers who looked at me funny when I wanted to write speculative fiction. And then in 2006, I attended the Bible Paradise week-long sci-fi workshop, which was fantastic and instrumental in pushing me where I am today, just 2 years later. But still, it's still moving me.
I'm Jim Kelly. I'm also going to flog stuff. Do you want to flog anything, by the way? You already flogged something.
I've got many things to flog. I actually have bookmarks.
Okay, good. Do you want to flog anything?
I'm tired.
I know. I'm indefatigable here. I'm going to flog my upcoming short story collection. Oh, by the way, I'm James Patrick Kelly. Upcoming short story collection, Wreck of the Godspeed, in August. And if you've been following me around, you know what I'm going to say now. I do a podcast for pay on Audible, which means you can't get it unless you pay something, unless you happen to be sitting in this audience right now, because I'm giving away free CDs, two episodes of James Patrick Kelly's Story Pod. Come get them at the end. Actually, I said this last night, since I brought too many. If you have a friend who you'd like to give one to, take two, please. Okay, and my writing credentials, oh man, this is gonna take forever. Okay, so I was an English major, and so I studied, and my my senior thesis was a very bad college novel, which I only wrote about 100 pages of, but I passed. And then I got out of school and I went to Clarion. I went to Clarion twice, and I was actually the last person to go to the Clarion Writers Workshop twice, and because it didn't take the first time, no. And I'll talk a little bit more about why I did that. But I have been sort of a learning workshop junkie throughout my entire life. I've been to Clarion. I took a bunch of adult education courses after I got to college, as if I didn't have enough English literature study in college. I went to Clarion twice, and I've been in a workshop basically for the last 30 years, several different workshops, which I also count as part of the how you teach and how do you learn writing is to workshop with your fellow writers. David.
David Moldauer, editor at St. Martin's Press, and I also have had plenty of writing instruction. I used to take playwriting very seriously. And so all through college and after, that was my main focus. And then my writing experience was when I actually had a staff writing job, writing biographies. And I think that's really where I cut my teeth on writing in great quantities and having it torn to pieces again and again and again. So that's my experience with it.
So I'd like to throw a curveball at everyone in the room. How many people here are attending primarily for the new media side of the programming? And how many people are, would you say, here for the typical con thing with, you know, costuming and masquerade?
I mean the con, not this panel.
Yeah, no, I mean the whole con. I'm thinking about how many people here are actually sort of new media people, and how many people are sort of traditional, you'd say traditional, I come to cons, all different kind of cons, whether it's new media or not. But interesting. Because one of the things I want to talk about with some of the new media people is the really interesting and in some ways provocative to me notion that there's a gatekeeper. There are gatekeepers that are keeping people from publishing what they want to publish. And to some extent, those gatekeepers are seen to be the publishing industry. But I think a subtextual thing is that part of this, the gatekeeping thing, is those people who were the English teachers who were the evil English teachers who said, this is crap you're writing. Don't write this science fiction crap or these fairies. Don't write this humor. And so it seems to me there's a subtextual, I don't want to say prejudice, but underneath the surface of new media is a distrust of anybody who tells you how to write. And it occurs to me that this is something I'd like to talk about and examine. So I guess the question I put to the panel is, what can't be taught? Let's talk about the first part of this idea here. If we assume that there's things you can teach and things you can't teach, what do you think can't be taught?
Well, actually, last night, and I don't think the person is here, but somebody was talking to me last night about the issue of voice and whether the fact, whether new media, I mean, it was sort of a complicated discussion, but the idea of voice and whether people would start, you know, copying one voice or whether it'd be less originality and less, you know, fewer unique voices. And my opinion is that voice, whatever we call voice, which is a term you hear thrown around a lot on the editorial side, is not something that can be taught, and it's not something that can be faked. So as voice, you know, if voice is the thing where you can look at a paragraph of Hemingway and you can look at a paragraph of Faulkner and know exactly whose is whose without necessarily pointing at any one specific thing. Oh, short sentences or, you know, lack of punctuation or anything like that. And what I was saying to her was basically, voice is something you sort of build up like a muscle, or the example I used was posture. You can work on your posture, but the fact is once you start walking for a while, you're going to slump or hunch or do whatever you normally do. And in the same way, your voice, you can try to write like Hemingway, like James Fry does, but eventually, after you go long enough, you're going to start going back to your natural posture, and you're going to go back to your natural voice. And that voice is something that is built up from everything you've read, from everything you've ever written, the responses to everything you've ever written, and it's the most subconscious and integral part of your writing toolkit. And I think that's something that you can only build up like a callus. I don't think you can learn that.
That's so interesting, but you know, voice is such a big thing. I mean, one thing we talk about is he writes transparent prose, which is to say that you know there's no the style sort of disappears, but insofar as meaning can be communicated to a reader, it's communicated pretty directly. But I think what you're talking about is voice is also what issues, what subjects you write about, how well you do women, how well you do men, how well you do children, how well you do dogs. That sort of whole panoply of things that you know.
If you dissect it, if you look at any one particular thing, I think you can improve that specifically, like how well you write women. Sure, you can focus on that and read female characters and look at how they're treated and improve that skill. But there's also something else that goes beyond how you deal with a particular subject or your viewpoint on the world. There's just something about how you throw sentences together that you take for granted, you can never really point to, the way you alternate lengths of sentences and paragraphs, and the kinds of words you go for, not once, but over time, over great lengths of text, how, you know, the kinds of ways you put adjectives and verbs together. I mean, there's so many subtle decisions that you could not possibly choose to make consciously. You just have to let it go because you've got a story to write. You know, you've got things you want to get across. You can't sit there thinking about it and planning it out. And that's why, you know, outlining is so often really hard for people, because at a certain level, you really have to write from a subconscious place. You've got to let your brain be creative, and you think about it too much. You know, just like any skill, you think about what you're doing too much, and you get lost. You lose what you're doing.
That's interesting, because I think. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think that if we can kind of bisect that for a moment, I think there's a difference between authorial voice and narrative voice and trying to emulate a style and a character voice. For example, if you're doing something like television writing, where you're writing for specific characters who have to be consistent week to week, or at least reach a level of consistency that is recognizable to most of the viewership, then you are looking to imitate specific styles, specific patterns. You're absolutely looking at their speech pattern and trying to keep it consistent and so on. So, to a certain extent, I think you're absolutely right. The authorial voice is still going to shine through. What you choose to highlight, how you choose to work with the relationships of the characters and so on, it's going to show through whether it's one person's script or another person's script. But in terms of the actual narrative style, and we see it all the time, right, where people try to imitate a specific style, whether they're because they're writing in that milieu specifically, or whether because that's what they're trying out. But I think that it's true in terms of narrative voice, but in terms of trying to, you can actually kind of study and come up with something that's going to fit in within the whole genre, especially if you're talking about a shared universe or a shared work.
Yeah, well, this is so interesting to me to hear you say this, because, you know, we could do a whole panel on fanfic, which is actually, you know, quite a controversial subject in some. But so when you're writing fanfic, are you writing your sensibility in the world, or are you trying to write episodes of the show that didn't get written?
That's a question that is going to get you, if you ask 100 fanfic authors, you're going to get 1,000 answers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it all depends on the specific work, the aim of the work, and the author. But I do agree that even in most fanfic, I mean, if you're just looking at written fanfic, what you are looking at is somebody who's trying to fit something that feels as if it were real within that universe, but is going to eventually develop a narrative of an authorial voice.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're looking for also is to make sure that those characters are still identifiable.
So I come back to the question I asked David is, what do you think can't be taught?
I think that what you can't teach is how to listen, how to hear the difference between, I mean, you know, it takes a lot of training to hear the difference between a sentence that flows and a sentence that doesn't. I think that, I mean, obviously, you know, I'm going to get into the what you can, but, and I think what matters versus what is just sort of authorial self-indulgence,
mm-hmm.
That's something that takes a lot of self-training and self-awareness that really is a question of letting go, in some cases letting go of ego,
mm-hmm.
For the betterment of the work.
Right. How about it, Mara? What can't we teach?
First, I'm very tired, and so I'm one question behind. I do have something to push. I'm sorry, I can't do it, dude. I sold my first novel. I gotta say it. So it's coming out August. Playing for Keeps is the name. I have cards up here if you want to learn more about my website, murverse.com. All the stuff is there. What can't you teach? It's confidence. I've been wanting to be a writer since I was 12, and only. You know, and people were telling me I was talented, and people were encouraging me, but it wasn't until I decided that they might be right that I ever took any steps forward in anything, and it had to be my decision to accept this. And I know that's way broad, but only after I started getting some confidence. And yeah, you can mentor people, and you can lead them along, but that step, that confidence, that's your thing, completely, 100%, and whether you have support or not, it's all you, and if you don't have the confidence, you can't, no one can give it to you.
We're going to take questions at the end, because I do want to, I got a lot of ground to cover, but keep that thought in mind. I'm actually, even though I'm moderate, I'm going to shoot my mouth off here, because I actually am a gatekeeper, and I'm a gatekeeper in a couple of different ways. One of the ways I'm a gatekeeper is I teach at a creative writing MFA program, that's those guys who get diplomas and stuff. And so I'm on the, it's one of the few MFA programs that actually specialize in popular fiction. And so I read manuscripts of people who are applying to our program. And I also just finished this two, three months ago reading this year's submissions for Clarion 2008 in San Diego. So I've been thinking about this because as a gatekeeper, I'm looking at a manuscript and I'm trying to tell, where's the potential here? And what is it that I see in the manuscript that is intrinsically sound, and what is it I think that maybe we can help with? And so it occurs to me that there are the things that can't be taught is the what used to be called in the back, ads in the back of magazines, the restless need to write. And that means to me that I don't actually believe this, but I sort of half believe it when people say, well, even if I didn't get paid, I'd be writing. Well, okay. But I go back to my childhood. I used to write stories for myself when I was 9, you know, and then I would write science fiction stories. I would write all kinds of stories. I write wish fulfillment stories. I wish I could date this person, or I wish this something else with this person. So this is sort of part of my personality. And the other side of that is what Murr said, which is she calls it confidence, and I say persistence, or some people might say stupidity, which is to say that when people tell you can't write, very smart people tell you can't write, and you don't accept that, maybe you're stupid. And there are some people who I'll ask can't write and are stupid. But the fact of the matter is, some people who are told they can't write actually go on and have great careers because they have that persistence, that and they have that self-confidence that maybe they didn't get from someone else, but they just go for it. So that restless need to write and the persistence is really, really important. Something I look at all the time in manuscripts is, does this person show any signs of social intelligence? Which is to say, do his characters pick up on cues? Are they real people? Are they just spouting ideas back and forth? Are they sock puppets that, you know, he is or she is has put on the page? And that's a really hard thing to say, and it's a really dicey proposition. But I know it when it's definitely not there. And it's only when that sort of shading into, well, he's got a little bit of that. Because to be a writer is to be able to step outside yourself and perceive how other people perceive the world. You have to exit the skull and jump into someone else's skull. You don't get there all the way, but you have to be able to at least make the gesture. And so if you can't do that, you can't be a writer. And the other thing, and this is the hardest thing to guess, and I often guess wrong when I'm reading manuscripts, is does this person have the ability to learn? Which is to say that some people we let into a program and they arrive because all they really want to do is meet the authors at Clarion or get the sheepskin at the end of the MFA program, and they don't want to learn anything. They just want to go through the process because they're already complete. And these people are dangerous to a program because they erode the fabric of trust that goes on in a workshop or in a classroom. Because if they think they're right, then there's another professor sitting out there arguing with you about you know, what is good, what is quality literature. Which isn't to say that students don't argue with us all the time, but when someone has consistently decided that they have their worldview is the worldview and that their prose is perfect, well, then they shouldn't have come to a program to try to learn. And so sometimes you can get that from the resume. Lots of times you can get it from the essay that people write. If you're ever applying to a thing, think very carefully about that essay to say why you want to go to Clarion, why you want to go to an MFA program. So those are the things I think that can't be taught. So what can be taught?
To me?
Yeah, why not?
Okay, what can be taught? Well, I work with authors all the time, and very frequently I work with first-time authors because I primarily edit nonfiction. And so I'll bring in an expert who might know his topic very well but has never really written a book before. I'll also work very frequently with bloggers who write lots on their blogs but have never written a long-form book before. And that's an experience trying to show someone how your techniques have to change when you are not writing something immediate. I mean, whatever you get out of a blog, there's sort of an immediacy, there's a direct, you know, connection, it's as if you're having a conversation, and there's a modification that has to happen. And that's something that can be taught is the structural work of building a book. The looking at it from the top down, because when you get into the trenches, I mean, that's literally what you're doing when you're writing your book from front to back. You're in the trenches. You see the turns ahead of you. And you can try to get a sense of the larger picture, but it's really hard. And so at the end of the process, when it comes to a publisher, or if you're just having a friend look it over, they'll look from the top down, and they'll say, well, hold on a second. You know, your first chapter is half the book. And then you have, like, 11 more chapters in the next half. Like, there's something off about the way you've built this story. And now it's time to start cutting things up and moving them around. And getting a feel for that is something that you can show someone and that they can get the hang of. It's just not something that you necessarily will discover on your own, because to you, that's the story. When you finish your book, that's what happens. You know, after this character does this, that's how it's been, that's how I created it. And the idea that you can actually lift things up and move chunks around and tear it up and that it will be okay, I think that's the trust factor, that you can cut a chapter and somehow organically, you know, there's a really great piece of writing advice I've heard lots of times, so I'm not even sure who to thank, but basically the idea that when you write a scene, you can cut off like the first page and the last page, and 9 times out of 10, it'll be better. And that's really hard to get into it. What do you mean? That's so, I'm telling you what's happening in the first page and last page. I tell you what just happened. And it's like, exactly. You don't need to tell us what's going to happen because it happens and you're in the middle. And you don't have to tell us what just happened because we just saw it happen.
Right.
And it's those kinds of techniques that you can show someone and then they trust you, they do it, and they realize that, oh, whoa, I actually didn't need to tell the reader what just happened. I can just trust them.
There's a real a standard workshop saying is that your story starts on page X, 9, 2, 5. And what happens lots of times is a writer walks into a story and looks around. Well, this is a nice room. There's some lights here. And there's a lot of nice people in the audience. There's a guy with a red shirt over there. And then, oh, the panel's starting. But, you know, that whole thing of, like, introducing, which is actually a pernicious thing from movies, where you zoom down from the sky and you look around and say, the quiet town, you drive down. No, start with the action. What can be taught?
I like to think of the writing as the two-step process, which is you get the whole creativity and you get the burning need and all that stuff that we tend to feel is taught, not taught. And that's the writing and, you know, but then there's the editing part where you have to be cold and logical and clinical. And what you do during the editing part is that's what has to be taught, because that's when you teach people how you can teach people what to look for, what to cut. And as you know, David said, the structure you have to look at it as a whole, see if the structure works, and then like all the rules that you may not have learned ingrained well enough to just do it when you're in your creative mode. For example, show don't tell. Once you're in editing mode, you're gonna go like, oh, that's completely telling. I have to rewrite this scene, and your cold logic brain can go, all right, this needs to be fixed. So I think the editing is a more teachable thing.
Mm-hmm.
I talk good.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I also do a lot of editing, and I think my dad, who's also been a creative writing and composition and linguistics professor for many, many years, he and I talk about it a lot because we actually edit each other's stuff. He'll like call me up, I'm writing a letter, help me, you know. And we've always said that you can actually do more with a good writer than you can a bad writer, because not just for the obvious reasons, but because if you've got something there to begin with, then you've got something to work with. And if they know the rules of grammar to begin with, or if they're not struggling with how do I actually, you know, put this vocabulary together, how do I structure this, then you can actually like tear right in. And also they're not going to be a special snowflake about it and you know, be but I am perfect and unique. I think that you can teach methods of research. I think that you can teach how to observe. I think that you can teach, you know, mechanical things such as dialect patterns and when you're doing too much dialect, you know, how to listen, you know, to read your stuff out loud. Does it flow? Does it make sense? I think you can teach, to some extent, I think you can teach discipline.
Hmm. Well, it occurs to me that, you know, one thing that's been going on, the enterprise of Western civilization, is that people have been writing for 4,000 years, you know? And so if you want to start over from 2000 BC and sort of work your way up to the present, you're welcome to it. But, you know, it seems like that's a lot of grief for people who've already done the work that you might want to know about. For instance, one of the things I see a lot is people who are writing don't understand point of view. I mean, it seems, I'm sure all of you understand point of view, but I'm saying there are people out there, probably in Wisconsin, I don't know, or Idaho or something, who don't understand point of view. But you know, so they will hand a manuscript in, and which point of view is floating all over, because they need to have this character needs to, they need to be in this character's head because this character has key point of plot information, but they only pop in there to find that plot information out and then go to another place. And so, and they say, well, what's wrong with that? I'm in omniscient point of view, God's point of view. Well, yeah. That's okay if you're good at it, but you know, one of the things that happens is readers are used to reading in limited points of view. They get confused. What character am I in? And the writer, who is not taken any courses or hasn't done any organized study of how literature has been working for the last 4,000 years, won't understand that that's a problem. I mean, and there are all these. Now you may think they're tricks. But in fact, they're the tricks that Shakespeare used, and Faulkner used, and Isaac Asimov used, and Robert Heinlein used, and Neil Gaiman used, and you know, like rising action, raising the stakes. You may have sort of an intuitive idea that, yeah, the story should get more exciting the farther along it gets. Well, yeah, that's right. But there's actually people who have thought very hard about how you accomplish that. And it can't be a straight line. It has to be sort of up and down a little bit. Otherwise, the reader will be very tired. And so. Now, some people say, "Oh my God, that's like English major stuff. Don't take. I don't want to go there. That's bad. You know, you'll pollute my pure writerly spirit." Okay, go back to Sumerian and start from there and start working your way back toward us. But that's it. Really, in some ways, is sabotaging your own career, because you will eventually learn all this stuff if you have that restless need to write and that persistence / stupidity that you keep on going no matter how many people tell you you can't do it. Eventually you'll learn all that stuff, but why do you have to learn it on your own when you can maybe get a writing book or talk to a writing teacher? Which brings me to my next question, which is, and we'll start over this way this time, how do we teach writing? How would you teach writing?
I teach writing. Well, there's, I'm going to put on one of my other hats for a moment, because as part of my life in fandom, I'm also one of the founding administrators of a site called Fiction Alley, which is a Harry Potter archive. But we incorporated as an educational nonprofit, and one of the things that we do is we teach writing. And we do it through what's becoming known as the beta reading process, which is slightly different than the editing process, but it has a lot in common with it. And beta reading, it's mainly a matchup kind of a thing where you get matched, or you have people who are hopefully not necessarily your best friend who's just going to tell you, oh, this is great, this is awesome, but somebody who knows what they're talking about, knows the basics, and can look at your work clinically, and who can say to you, and it's not so much I've gotten feedback from professional editors before, where I hate this section, fix it. Well, that's really helpful. Fix it how? Whereas in the beta reading process, a lot of times it's more of a partnership where they say, okay, this part isn't working. See if you can da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And, you've written yourself in this hole. Let's get you out of it. Let's figure out how we can fix this. Or as David said, I actually had a friend of mine say to me, my beta reader say to me, this needs to go over here and then it'll be better. I'm like, oh, okay, yay. Because I think a lot of times when you're writing, you are so close to it that you can't necessarily pull back and look at it and say, something's not working, but what is not working? Or you've been so inside it for so long that it's ingrained in your head and you can't necessarily take it apart. You need somebody who can kind of like pull it all apart and rip the seams out, kind of. So I think one of the more effective ways to teach is in sort of that kind of one-on-one relationship where you can really get into the work. Obviously, it's one of the things that you teach by using primary source material. In other words, you can't just kind of teach with nothing.
Yep.
You have to have something to work with. You have to have their writing sample that you can then take apart and pick at it and just write and write and write and write.
I have a podcast called I Should Be Writing, where I should be writing.com.
No, that's good. Oh. That's great podcast. I like it.
It's it it's basically me going through my issues about writing and how I'm trying to get published. And the way I see it is I never ever lie about the fact that I'm like up on this mountain preaching down because I'm so much more experienced. The way I see it is I'm trying to climb the mountain and my listeners are perhaps like right behind me and I trip over a tree root. And that episode is, dude, don't trip over that tree root I just tripped over, which is like, here's what I've learned from all of my rejections. Here's what I've learned from this. And it's really just a, you know, seriously, don't trip over the tree root that I just did. This is what I just learned, and I'm going to try to tell you guys about it. And it's really, I'm just teaching by what I'm experiencing, my examples. Every once in a while, I do get an interview in by a real author who lets my listeners know that I'm not just bullshitting them. So that I try to get the pros on there so they can talk about, and I usually try to have them talk about what I had been podcasting about the previous three or four episodes, just to make sure that whatever they're saying either complements or reinforces what I had just said, or tells me I was wrong and sets people straight. So that's how I'm doing it. I'm really just trying to say, here's what I've experienced and what I've learned, and people seem to like it.
David, how do we teach?
I think the most effective technique that I have in terms of actually making an impact on the way a writer writes from then on, as opposed to editing what they've already done, is to focus on the lesson of what are you trying to accomplish? Because very often you'll have somebody come in and, you know, let's say somebody walked in this door right now and they tripped and they bumped their knee and then they found their seat. That is a piece of information. You could watch a video of it and you would get the idea that the person came in and tripped and then found their seat. But the way you choose to tell the story, you have to have a reason. What are you trying to do? Are you trying to make us nervous for that person? Are you trying to get across the idea that that person is clumsy? Are you trying to get past the idea that that person is charismatic? We should like that person because they tripped and we feel sympathy with them. You know, what are you trying to accomplish by writing the scene of the person tripping and then finding their seat and telling it to the reader? Because if you're not accomplishing something, then just show us the videotape. And that's not what writers are there to do. And I find that question, when I pose it to somebody, when they've given me something in any form, any sort of explaining something to the reader, I'm like, what are you trying to do here? Why did you tell it this way? And I find that as soon as that sort of forces the writer to step back and say, oh, it isn't just the question of describing what I see in my head. I actually can achieve different purposes with the same exact chunk of narrative. And that suddenly that allows them to start tearing things up and moving it around and saying, well, as long as I get across the idea that the person tripped, that's okay, and that's gonna happen. I can trust that. That by the end of this chapter, they'll figure out that the person tripped and then found their seat. Now I can move things around and maybe tell it from the perspective of someone sitting in the audience, or maybe somebody laughed at him, or, you know, and then that opens up a different kind of imagination than that sort of movie you have going on in your head when you're trying to write a story, because that's what comes first. And then it's a question of breaking it up so that you achieve an effect on top of telling the story.
Yeah. This is one of the things I ask all the time of my students is, why did you write this story? Well, you assigned it, or well, it was due, or well, I wanted to get into this anthology. No, why are you the only person in the universe who could possibly have told this story in this way? And if you don't know the answer to that, then you've got to go back and find it out in the text of your story. But I want to say something about learning to be a writer that seems basic, but that somehow gets lost. And actually, this is probably one of the dark sides of being a writer, and that is, in order to learn to be a writer, you have to learn to read like a writer. And in order to learn to read like a writer, you have to some extent, sacrifice the pleasure of reading. Because you can't let yourself get immersed in the story. You have to pull back and say, how did this guy do that? You know, one of the things that that is really, to me, a feature and a bug of science fiction, of the genre, is that we're in discourse with our elders. We're all reading stories and saying, oh, I could write better than that, or he was wrong about that, or, ooh, I could steal that, but glom it onto this, and then all of a sudden I got that. And so, but all too often I find people who haven't read. And when you say, well, when I ask a would-be writer, well, who are your influences? Well, you know, I started watching the Star Wars series. I have all the figurines, you know. But what have you read? You know, and who are your literary models? Who speaks deeply to your writerly soul? And the more it comes from media, the less confident I am that those people are, are going to make it. But even if they say, okay, I love everything that Robert Jordan ever wrote. Okay, fine. What do you like about it? Well, it's like, I just fell into it. It spoke to me, and I like a plot. This tells me that this writer who has had a very deep reaction to Robert Jordan hasn't really looked at how Robert Jordan has got him. And so in order to learn how to be a writer, you have to learn how your favorite writer got you. And in order to do that, you have to sort of sabotage the relationship that you had with that writer. And you have to, like, you know, pull the hood off and, you know, take the wheels off, and, like, all of a sudden that your favorite thing may be just, you know, on the floor in front of you and it will never run again, but boy, you'll know how it works. So reading like a writer and stealing from the best. These are the things. But then, of course, then we could talk about workshops and stuff like that. But the beta thing is really sort of interesting to me because it sort of recapitulates the whole workshop idea, which is that you bring your stuff to a workshop, and some workshops there is a chief, like a writer, like the instructor. But I continue to be in workshops where there's no chief. It's like 6-8 writers, all of whom are published, all of whom have their own agendas, all of whom have their own careers, and we sit around and say, well, you know, you did that before, or this is great, or did you know this is going on here? And that kind of feedback is part of the learning process, part of learning how to be a writer. Because once you publish, you don't stop learning. A writer who has stopped learning has stopped writing. He is just recapitulating what he already knows. And so if you're not trying something new all the time, if you're not learning from your mistakes, if you're not learning, then you're not writing. And so, but I actually think that part of the process of learning to be a writer can actually be in a structured program. And we could talk about that if you want, but nonetheless, it's not to be regarded as soul crushing. There are soul crushing writing programs, but most of them are good for the people who stick through them and get them done. Maybe it's time for some Q&A. Anyone out there have some cues? Yep, there's a cue.
A couple things came to mind when we were talking. One was about plotting, PLOTTING, instead of DDING.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I read about. Yale Doctorow has this great quote about when you're writing, and that's you're supposed to be in a car on a dark road, and you know where you're going in the dark, but you can only see what's in the headlights in front.
Right.
And he says that's how you should write. And that reminded me, I was lucky enough to come to Philip Jose Farmer, and I asked him how he wrote the book, and he says, I just write stories. And if I finish and there's a short story, it's a short story. But he just writes. And then when he's done, if it's a book length, he goes back and does all the grammatical correction, all that. Then he chapterizes, and he said he goes through and picks, he comes across a sentence that makes him as a reader go, then what happens? And I goes, okay, another chapter. Mm-hmm. So I asked him, how about the final chapter? He says, yeah, that's what I do there, because that's where sequel money comes in. And then one more thing is about the gatekeepers, and I think you need them, because I joined Live Journal and I was immediately inundated with crappy vampire stories. And the guy asked me for a critique, and I said, okay, in your first paragraph you have third person and omniscient voice, and you have different verb tenses. What the hell do you know about writing? Yeah. Well, I'm one of those guys getting sheepskin, so I know a little bit about it. And the other one was I had to read a script, and it's the evil Egyptian script, and if I read it to you, you would all throw your coffee cups. If I quoted the first few lines, was that horrible? You need gatekeepers, because there's crap out there, and I don't want to waste it. Just reading that story was 5 minutes of my time, and never going to get back to my life.
I want to talk about plotting just briefly. I mean, because you mentioned, you know, outliners have it hard in some ways, but I know lots of, I think Connie Willis outlines. She doesn't know everything, but she's a much more outlining kind of writer than I am. So,
oh yeah, I didn't mean to say that you shouldn't do that. I just said that I was meaning that sometimes that's hard, that some writers find that process difficult because they, you know, getting in the zone, the creative zone, is hard. And sometimes you can obstruct yourself by saying, this is where you need to be in 5 pages. And sometimes for some writers, that can be hard to get back in the zone and write creatively, and because you keep looking at that signpost. I gotta get there somehow. Whereas other writers like Philip Jose Farmer, they're just going. And somehow, thanks to their talent and luck and skill, that worked for them. And it's different for everybody. But as far as plotting goes, for some writers, it's something that you can own, that evolves naturally. I mean, you can't help but have a plot. That's one thing. Just like a voice, a plot will come because there's always something that happens next. And what you'll find as you write, especially when you write very, very long stretches, is things will start popping up. One character will walk in and you'll say, well, wait a second. Let's make that character from the first scene. And why would that character from the first scene be in this room? Oh, maybe that character had a plan. And it's just natural. The tricky part then is when you're editing it, a lot of that stuff just won't work. And you'll have to shift it and move it around. But you can't avoid having a plot. Usually it's just a question of making it the most effective one that it can be.
Murr.
Plotting?
Yeah.
This is something I've tried the outlining thing, and on a broad sense for me it works. I do some podcast fiction that's episodic, and I try to plan out a whole season. So I was first writing completely organically, and when I got to the second season, I started to falter, and I realized I needed to know in broad terms what each episode was going to be about. And so I made a little paragraph about each episode, and that made the rest of it a lot easier. But overall, I prefer the organic way of driving around with the headlights on. And it excites me, and most of the time it works for me. I remember I knew I had to write a cab scene in a recent work in progress, and thinking about it made me bored. I just did not, you know, I had to do the, okay, we got to get from A to B. I don't want to teleport there, but I don't want it to be boring, and I didn't know what I was going to do until I started writing, and it became a really fun scene. But I didn't know it was going to be a really fun scene until I started writing it, and I don't think I could have outlined that. Mm. It's just not the way I think.
Yeah. Lee, do you want to talk about this?
Sure. I kind of do a little bit of both. To me, the most important part, just personally for myself, is knowing what my end point is. If I don't know the end of the story, or at least the goal of the story, then I find it almost impossible to get there. And I'll come up, because I'm really great at coming up with concepts. Concept gets you 4 pages, and then you're stuck. And then you're like, okay, well, now what? Crap. But if I know the end, then frequently what will happen is then the outline basically writes itself, because I at least know that to get to there, this seminal event has to happen, this has to happen, and this would be kind of cool. And then I can get there. And I try not to structure it to, like you said, you don't want to overstructure it, because you want to be able to be organic. You want to be able to say, I don't know if I can get an entire chapter out of this character, but oh, yep, there it is. Okay, yay. And you have to be willing to make those discoveries along the way as well. I think the most exciting thing is when you're writing something and you go, oh my God, I never knew that that was that character's motivation. Wow!
Yeah.
Sweet.
Yeah, that's the drug of writing, when your own writing surprises the hell out
exactly.
of you.
Exactly, and you have to be willing to let it go there. And if that jostles something on your outline, let it go. Yeah. Change it, because what you're coming up with on the fly is likely going to be better. The reason it was a brainstorm is because there's something that connected there. So I've done both with outlines, without outlines, at least with some end point in mind. One of the hardest experiences that I had recently was the story that is in Badass Fairies 2, Launch Party Tonight. go by the book. Because the whole concept of this particular volume is that all the unconventional fairies were supposed to be villains. And so we were getting all these submissions where there was like death, doom, gloom, despair, misery. And we're like, wow, this is really getting heavy. So those of us who were editors were trying to kind of fill in the holes. And our editor-in-chief said to me, well, okay, so we need something that does this and this. Try to hit a kind of fairy that we haven't had before, but try for there to not be any more death. We don't want any more body count. And make it kind of lighter. And, you know, so it was kind of like, I went through like 4 different iterations. I was like, okay, well, you want me to either do voodoo, gangs, or something else, mercenaries, and no death. Voodoo and no death, great. and I kind of had to switch gears like 4 times before I found something that would work. And quite frankly, the story is a little bit stupid, but but it's silly and it's funny, and you know, and I came up with an endpoint, and I fully cheated. I completely, you know, ripped off the Dirty Dozen.
Mm. Do you have a question there?
Yeah, I wanted to bring up the fact that when you're learning, one thing you have to teach yourself is how to think for yourself. Because I've heard stories from Clarion, which is, wow, this person came in and they taught us for a week and it was intense and it was awesome. And then the next person came in and they said that, not verbatim, but everything they started to teach us was completely opposite what the previous person started to teach us. And I don't know what to do. And, you know, at Bible Paradise, the way you taught really spoke to me. And the way Corey taught really spoke to me. And Corey thinks that workshops are diminishing returns. Corey doesn't want to go to any more workshops. He did Clarion, he might have done some others, but he doesn't really do it anymore. And Jim Kelly is a self-proclaimed workshop junkie. And so clearly he does not think that. And I want to just make sure, how do we teach writers to think for themselves on that aspect, to know what we're babbling about to take and what to not?
You just have to, like, let it, you know, try it on and see if it fits. One of the things I, you know, say you take a manuscript to a workshop, and in a high-level workshop, you'll get, you know, people say this works, this doesn't work, but you also get people saying, well, you know, I think that the sister did it, or I think that you should maybe move this to Vancouver, because, or, you know, all these ideas, and some of them say, oh, in the moment of the workshop, say, oh my God, that's exactly right, because sometimes there's a very charismatic person advocating for this change, and so you write this stuff down. What I always tell my students is, okay, if you're in a workshop like that where you're getting a lot of ideas, master all the comments onto one thing and then put it away for a while, and then don't look at it when you rewrite. Whatever you remember from having written it down is the right thing, you know. But it's true. It can be very confusing and daunting to people who get into a workshop where very smart people are advocating for the exact opposite or different, anyway, outcomes for the story. We should take more questions. Who's out there? What's in front? The question is, I mean, is there a moment sometimes where everything makes sense, and to some extent there is. I mean, some people say this is when the writer finds his voice or her voice, you know. I published 10 stories before I actually found my voice, so to speak, and I wouldn't recommend any of those 10 stories even though they got published. Matter of fact, you know, they will never be anthologized in any anthology. But I think that sort of finding your voice moment of St. Paul and the road to Damascus, getting it all of a sudden, doesn't come to a beginning writer. It should come further down the line. And yeah, the point has already been made, I think, that, you know, you can't, if you're not willing to hear that your baby is ugly, then you can't help them get handsome. Take another question. Way in the back. Yeah, you.
When you have a story,
oh yeah, you said yes, so what
yes.
is it?
Yes. I don't know, I think it's different, it may be different for author from author to author, but I think it's definitely different from story to story. There are times when I've made the conscious decision that I want to play with XYZ technique, and therefore the next project that comes along is the one that I'm going to try that with. Or I feel that the plot that I want to convey or the character study that I want to inject calls for a particular point of view, or that I want an outsider's point of view. I want to get outside of the relationship of the two main characters so that everybody knows, you know, so that you're getting a perspective that is not necessarily privy to everything that they know. it all depends on what you're writing and how you're writing it. I mean, if you look at, I think George R. R. Martin is a great example, where, you know, the way that he decided that there are certain points of view for Song of Ice and Fire that will tell the story, and then he got the fourth book, and he's like, oh, I have to open it up. Mm. And now he's in trouble because he had to open it up.
Yeah. It's a good answer to that question. Another question, over here.
I have a mechanical question for you. Anyone who follows, my name's Ken DuBois, anyone who's followed Murr and I on Twitter, which is kind of somewhat amusing, but how do you teach a writer respect for deadlines?
How do you teach a writer? Here's the thing. Respect for deadlines. You don't pay him.
For me, I was a newspaper reporter for 2 years, so me, deadlines are fast, but for normal people, I'd be curious to hear how that plays out.
Ken and I write for the same magazine, Nights at the Dinner Table, and I don't miss deadlines, but it really helps me that Ken starts complaining about his column like the day before it's due, which reminds me that mine's due, and so that's why he's asking. Sorry, go ahead, David.
This is kind of funny. I'm not going to name any names, but I had a manuscript come in, and I was late on it, and I finally got a chance. I was like, okay, I'm going to do it this weekend. I got to get this done, and I'm editing it, and something's wrong. Something feels wrong to me, and then I realize that it's too short. And I realize it's way too short, and I realize it's missing 30 of 100 sections that it should have. And so I called the author, and I'm like, what's going on here? Where's the rest of the book? And he's like, oh, well, I thought since everything was rushed, I thought you'd want, what I had. As if this was like a class, like a homework, like I couldn't write the whole
partial.
Like a partial. And he didn't even tell me. I was like, are you kidding? That's not how it works. You can't give me a partial book. This is the book. This is what's going out into the world. And in his mindset, he just thought he could give me part of the book, because at least it would be hitting that deadline. The deadline is artificial. We set deadlines to publish a book summer of 09, winter of 08, and that's great, but if there's no book, there's no publishing. We move the book, or we cancel the book.
Right.
And so for me as an editor, the deadline is not an astronomical event. it's a tool, And is J.C. Hutchinson in the audience?
No.
It's a tool. It's not real. It's not real. I use it as a carrot and a stick.
Yeah, right.
If it's helping, if the writer sort of gets a little, sometimes a deadline can be very helpful if it's a realistic deadline. And
came in the door. He just stuck his head in the door.
Yeah. So if it's a realistic deadline, it can get you jazzed. If it's ridiculous, sometimes it can shut you down. And so for me, it's a question of getting a feel for the writer and saying, okay, this is somebody who feels very confident. If I give him a good deadline, he's going to toss it out. And in some other writers, another writer, I'm not going to name any names, I just stepped back and I was like, you know what? We're taking the book off the schedule. You just finish the book when you can finish the book. Because I could tell that deadline was just shutting them down. And that's the reality of it. And then my job to go figure out, catalogs and things like that. But the deadline is just a tool. And for when you're giving yourself a deadline, that it's the same thing. You don't want to set something unrealistic that's going to shut you down. But on the other hand, you might need some sort of deadline just to keep yourself going.
Friends, I'm afraid this is the last question and you're it.
So I know that for some writers that I've heard, they say, wait until they get an idea to what they write. They have to have that inspiration. Well, how do you teach yourself to find that? Because it feels like that, there's a lot more out there to inspire you than most people see. So how do you teach yourself to find that inspiration?
Anybody want to talk about that?
I actually started a blog called The News from Poughkeepsie because I got tired of people saying, I've got this great idea for a book, but I'm not going to tell you because I'm afraid someone's going to steal it. And ideas are cheap. Ideas, they come all the time, and you can either write them down or do something with them, or you can just go, hey, that's kind of cool, ooh, shiny. And, and what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to, A, force myself to think of something new every day. I keep this blog every day. And I'm also trying to tell people that you can take this and do whatever you want to with it. Make $1 million. I don't care because ideas are cheap. And if I wanted to do something with it, I would. And I might. I've got a blog full of ideas now. But it's like sometimes I'll be sitting there going, crap, I haven't made a blog post today. What am I going to do? And because I've made this my thing. I have to do it. This is my own self-imposed deadline. It's sweating the blood. I have to do it. There's no question. So you know, you just do it.
I'm very much of a mind with Murr here. You know, it's hard when you're just starting out, but you should have a bunch of ideas, and when it comes time to write, you should pick the idea that means the most to you and go with it. Because if you're waiting around for inspiration, that's hard to come by. Inspiration will come sometime in the middle of the manuscript. But pick the one idea that you have that really means something to you, that you think you're the one unique person in the universe to write it, and then start that, and I guarantee you inspiration will come, or else you're not a writer. And for that, thank you very much. Free flag.
Bookmarks.
Come get it.